This is Dennis Goldring, recorded at his home in Gisborough, Teesside, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 23rd of May, 2010. Dennis Goldring, Part 2.
Would you say the second year was happier than your first year?
It was fantastic.
Why was that?
The amount of work that was done. I'd had a pretty good first year, but the second year was out of this world.
Go on.
The ice formed. There was a southerly hurricane, and the ice did not go out. Knowing the background, I was convinced that it wasn't going to go out. no way would it go out. That enabled us. The second thing was that a set of aerial photographs had arrived from done by hunting surveys the previous summer. The new base leader surveyor, Brian Foote, had put these together and had produced an approximate, well, a fairly good, but not absolutely, but not the final edition sort of thing, but a good map of the area, including the very big area called now called Crystal Sound. So these were factors which would enable geology to be done over that whole area by sledge. There'd be no other way really of ever doing it. Even now, difficult to do. I mean, it would need the flipping research vessel to be standing by the geologist with his dinghy all the time. And, you know, they just haven't got the amount of money to do that. So, you know, everything was there to get a lot of geology done. And it was done. You know, this really enabled a really good appreciation of the Lube Coast, effectively. Geology and, well, of course, the survey could have been done later as well, modern methods, but, a lot of credit to Brian Foote as well.
So just, can you compare the qualities of Erskine and Foote, the two guys you...
They were very, very different.
In what respect?
Erskine was a polar explorer, basically.
Heroic period.
Yes. Mm. But also with a very good dash of being able to take in the needs of lesser persons. extremely good, very charismatic as well. Brian was a very, very good surveyor. He'd been on the Ordnance Survey in UK. He was effective as a base leader. He was more pernickety about keeping the place clean and tidy, for instance. He also was interested in doing good sledge journeys and so on. He didn't want to have much to do with dogs. He preferred to go back to the old system of having a dog driver. Mm-hmm. But in his way, he was very effective. I think the base everything went well at the base with him, without having this charismatic setup. But with the ice conditions changing as they did, then obviously Angus wouldn't have been so effective in that second year. He would have been wanting to go on a long plateau journey, I'm quite sure. That was the sort of thing which people still wanted to do in the second year. There was a lot of preparation work. Brian was intending to do a long, lengthy plateau journey northwards to parts of the plateau which hadn't previously been reached, a small party eventually did, but I persuaded Brian to stay on the sea ice because it became so obvious that that's where the scientific work was could be done then, and there probably wouldn't be another opportunity in the future. And of course, it would be us who were doing it for our own personal benefit.
So the sea ice gave you access to all the cliffs and the coastal rocks.
Yes, but particularly these little islands. The place is absolutely dotted, even like Ambers. It was dotted with small islands, mostly covered with little ice caps, but with rocky outcrops around. And it gave us access to literally hordes of those. Mm. Initially I was out with one or two of the Met assistants, and again the radio officer Colin Johnson, and Paddy, who was one of the Met assistants, working that went on, and then Brian was more interested in doing. He was also doing the surveying at the same time, but he was also getting a third group of people to get depots laid up the glacier to get onto the plateau, and he was intending to go on a plateau journey, and it wasn't till quite late, November, that I persuaded him to change his mind and alter the arrangement so that he and I stayed as the team on the sea ice, and the other group went off on their plateau journey. So, which I think was probably the right thing to do.
How much geology could you do back in the hut once you'd got your samples together?
I never had time really to do much in the hut. I could have done some. I should probably have done more, but I was literally always busy. Well, we didn't spend any time in the flipping hut. that year, once we were out, we eventually got back to base sometime in. We were out roughly from July to January, with very very short periods in the hut. So
how was that? Yeah, again, here's the chap who'd never done any mountaineering. And how was it that you spent so much time away from the security of a base? You were in the field for such a long period of time.
There's no problem. not mountaineering. No mountaineering. The sea ice was fast. One was merely camping as you would in the UK. One was dog sledging, but there was no great problem with that. obviously there was a fair bit of bad weather lying up time. We did have our problems. We certainly got extremely tired at times because of there being 24-hour more or less daylight, and we had to travel at night because of the harder snow condition. The surface would harden up a little bit, but there wasn't enough light to do the geology, so you had to do the geology and survey during the day. So between the two of those, if it snowed for a day or two and we had to lie up, so much the better, because then we'd have a good night's sleep, or a good day's sleep, I should say. But, we were very tired when we eventually got back to base, I must admit, and obviously that the ship was going to pick us up and take both Brian and myself and several of the other methods that people on base back to UK. We were thinking that the ship might arrive in late January, so we'd come back to base in late January. And I think at that point, certainly I was tired and probably getting a little bit cheesed off. and looking forward to getting back home. And of course, you know, the ship did not come.
Well, I was going to ask, we could talk about that now if you like. the escape from detail. Yeah. Tell me about that process. The ship was due in March, I believe, is that right?
Well, it was due probably, hopefully, in late February.
Was this the Bisco again?
Bisco, yes.
What went wrong?
Sea ice, the pack, and then the fast ice. In Crystal Sound, and in Lallaman Field, and in Darbal Bay. So eventually, when the ship did get got to about 25 miles away, with the help of American icebreaker, North Wind and Adisto too, which had already been helping it, actually, at least one of them had. So when it did come, they were out at the Scillard Islands, about 25 miles out. Saying, right, well, we'll resupply the base. And the first thing they do is a whole group of people who are due to take over from us arrive. Numbers in the base virtually goes up to 16, 17, 18, even more perhaps, temporarily. They start trying to get the stores that 25 miles to the base, year's supply, using a helicopter. Now, helicopters in those days were very poor, little... take only one or two persons, you know, very, very, very small load, proved pretty useless. Dog sledges weren't up to the amount of material. They had a tractor pulling a bigger sledge, which also wasn't up to the job. So there was no way that the base was going to be resupplied. There were a lot of argy-bargy between the ship, who was in more or less in control. The captain would have been in total overall control, I imagine, the base leader, Brian, and Sec Fids in Port Stanley. Obviously, there were various plans afoot to how you could let people spend the whole year camping and sort of close the hut down, which were eventually decided as not being satisfactory. Time went on. There were several weeks mucking about. The decision suddenly to abandon, which was done. Just trying to think. I should say that there was a key reason which nobody seemed to want to know about, as to why the key thing: there was not enough anthracite for the hut to be kept warm that whole year. There was very little anthracite left on base. Now, the base should have had a whole year's supply of anthracite. That was the rule, they were always 1 year ahead. Sec Fids insisted that this was so. The base has a year's supply of anthracite. You know, what's the matter? We don't need any more anthracite. Brian Foote said, we have no anthracite. Now, why was this? The reason was that seems to have got lost in the mist is that when I first arrived at Base W, they unloaded the whole year's supply of anthracite into the scow, and loaded it down to water flowed over it, and it capsized. And all the anthracite fell out into the sea.
So you lost a year's supply.
We lost a year's supply.
In one moment.
In one moment, yes. Two years before, you say.
And nobody had told.
SecFids, this had not got recorded, so that an extra year's supply, the previous year, a 2 years' supply should have been unloaded rather than one. That's how it had actually happened.
So Brian Foots had his way, did he? His argument prevailed.
Well, his prevailed, yes, of course. Mm. People realised there wasn't. It didn't seem practical that people should live in tents all the year, Brian Foote's way prevailed. Yes, the captain decided that the base had to be. But of course, then that was done in a rush. So you were told to virtually close the place down within a matter of 24 hours, something like that.
The Biscoe had been stuck out at sea on the end of the ice for quite a long time, had it?
Oh yes, weeks. Yeah, two or three weeks. I wouldn't like to say. I'd have to look up the diary to check that.
So once the decision had been taken to abandon.
No decision, of course, various options thought about, various tries to resupply, an argument going on about anthracite, which is finally resolved that there isn't any, and then a decision to, either by the captain or SecFids, to abandon forthwith. Meaning quick, and the place is more or less left, more or less in a state of operation, as is seen in these pictures.
So you all sledged out to the boat.
Yes,
and the men who were going to take over from you,
including them, the whole bally lot. We took out obviously. Well, not even all our personal belongings.
You took your samples, I presume?
I took my samples, yeah. A load of samples came out. I left a case full of personal clothes for some reason or other. And when I got back home, I claimed on the insurance, got £30. A year later, they actually came back. The insurance company didn't want to know. I also left quite some important notes inadvertently. Somebody else, I thought they were on somebody else's sledge, which is a bad mistake on my part. You look after your own things. And then when we got out to the ship, they weren't on. He hadn't got them. So they'd been left at the base. He thought that he'd bought some other thing instead. So that was a bit unfortunate, but again, I got those back 1 year afterwards, so it didn't actually.
So somebody got to detail the following year briefly.
They got briefly to detail the following year and collected some of this gear. Yeah, why they didn't completely take all key things out of the base, I don't know. If they left all this reports and things lying around, seems a bit strange that they had the opportunity to do so.
There was an incident when you all got to the boat when one of the dogs decided not to come with you.
Yeah, I knew nothing about that. We got to the ship. There's the two icebreakers also there. There was not another. The Biscoe was very crowded, obviously. So quite a big group of us. They got all the dogs on board the Biscoe. They then allocated a group of us to go on the Edisto, American icebreaker. I got up onto the Edisto. They showed me to a bunk, and I went to sleep. And about 14 hours later, woke up and got out on deck, found we were up near Base F, up in heavy pack with the Edisto. Now, I've been told about that later, Steve, I think it was. Mm. and the amazing journey to Horseshoe.
Had been, in the base reports in 57 and 56, it had been suggested as early as that detail wasn't a viable base, really. So was it inevitable it would close down?
Well, we were expecting to be for it to be resupplied, and you know we'd made all the plans for it to be an effective sledging base. We were going to the sledging activities were going to be mostly moved to the refuge hut, and there was a viable route up to the plateau, which there wasn't. For a long way up further north, they'd been tried to get onto the plateau in several places and failed. So we had a viable route. We also had Angus had arranged for a refuge hut to be set up in Darbal Bay as well on his second route up to the plateau. He had two good routes onto the plateau. So for looking at the doing the work on the plateau and getting over to the east side of the peninsula, there were good possibilities. Now, admittedly, there wasn't much geology to do on the west side because I virtually cleaned it up because of the good conditions. But getting over onto the east side would have been quite a big thing to do. But I would have said that Base W had possibilities. On the other hand, of course, the ship was having trouble. It hadn't had trouble previously. The reason had been that the ice had gone out. Having the ice staying in and the ship not getting there was a new one on them, I think.
So was it a surprise then to learn that Erskine, in his end-of-year report, had recommended the closure of the hut in 57?
Well, he would have recommended it on the basis that the hut was unreliable. Yes, very definitely at that stage. But he wouldn't have recommended I'm sure would have wanted refuge huts at Darbal Bay and the one on the east side of Lanman Field to continue to be used. He had plans for a Darbal Bay hut, or super refuge, I should say. Mm. So I think you're thinking of two slightly different things. Detail Island was a very unsatisfactory site for a hut, yes, but the area needed to be looked at, and we had two good accessible ways onto the plateau, with a possibility of getting over onto the east side, which had only been hardly touched. Aid had just gone past down there and collected a few samples here and there, but not very much.
One or two specific things to ask you about, if I may, Dennis. You had a somewhat of a lucky escape quite early on in the time you were there, when you had to spend two nights in a snow hole.
Yes.
And was that with John Smith as well?
That was with John Smith, yes.
There seem to be two John Smiths in the Antarctic.
Yes. Well, he went down there twice.
Is this the same chap who was at Fossil Bluff?
It's the same chap.
Oh, right.
Mm. I think he spent the first year at Cygni Island, second year at Base W, and then he came down a few years later and spent the year more or less at Fossil Bluff.
That's right, yeah.
So I think for just one year. Rather than the...
So I know who you mean. So tell me about this. These two nights in the snow.
Well, Angus had, and Jim Madell had left us to do some geology and then make our way back to the base. So we were going to make our way back down the Murphy Glacier. We did a bit of geology on a nice fine day, got caught in a storm which... made us lie up something like 8-9 days, went on to sort of half rations, this sort of thing. Then on a pretty bad day, set off back down the glacier, got so far looking for a small depot, couldn't find it, camped, and then made a bad mistake of taking a dog team out, which was already tired and had been on half rations, looking for the depot away from the tent. Found the depot, which was just sticking up a few inches, the tent pole, flagpole, the flagpole that we put there, snow, something like 5 or 6 feet of snow on top of it, dug it out, and then of course we just couldn't get back to the camp, which was only a mile or so back, I imagine. So we spent a couple of nights out. We're very lucky then that the conditions were, there was a northerly, so it wasn't all that cold. It was probably sort of minus 10, about 20 Fahrenheit, something like that. It was the southerlies where it would get really cold. Managed to dig ourselves in a bit, managed to eat some. We couldn't open our own ration boxes because we hadn't got any tool to do it. Spanner thing that you used to get the wire off. And but we could open the dog boxes, so we ate some Nutricon. we were, you know, and it cleared up sufficiently after a couple of days, and we managed to get back to the camp. That had got pretty snowed up as well by the time we got back. But I think we were lucky.
Did you think you were lucky at that time? Were you concerned for your safety?
Not particularly, no. No, I don't think so. We don't think any. You know, there's no different from somebody being out on up in the Striding Edge or somewhere in a bad storm. Mm. In fact, better than that, because you know at least we had some reasonably dry gear, and windproofs and so on. So I don't know whether what might have happened. But we were on the whole lucky. If it had got a lot colder, then I think we should probably have been in Queer Street. Of course, we were trying not to go to sleep, this sort of thing. And we were pretty cold by the time we got back to the camp. Certainly shivering a lot. But I think we might even have been okay. We should never have left the camp. You know, the tent and the sleeping bags was the all important thing. And we would have probably had to have. We weren't all that far. We were about 20 miles or so from the refuge hut, so we could have probably walked back. I think John had broken a ski, so I think that was probably wouldn't have helped. We could probably have walked back to the refuge hut.
Was there a dressing down for your mistakes when you got back to?
Oh no.
No base commander, no base leader.
No, Angus. Sorry. Angus. I at least, I don't know about John, but I was thought came back and was saying having this adventure. Yeah, almost a Scott like activity. you had to write a report, and you know it would go into the monthly report of FIDS. Angus said, no, we mustn't do that. It'll upset your parents, you see, relatives. So, so it was all rather. We did actually write a report, but that never went, as far as I know, back to Sec FIDS. And I would guess Fuchs got a hold of it later on, because there is a mention in a book it. But it's a trifling thing. You must realise, I mean, that three guys were lost the following year.
Well, I was going to come to that next. What are your thoughts? Which is the loss of Dave Statham, Stan Black and Jeff Stride on the sea ice around the Dion Islands?
Well, that I don't know what happened there.
Was it after your time?
No, it was in our second year.
Mm.
And the sea ice was in the process of forming. It was before the great storm I was talking about. And the sea ice in Lallemand Field had come and gone three or four times. And each time people were keen to go out, you know, you could go out, do a bit of sledging even around the island, sort of circling around up to a mile or so out, and shoot the odd seal, this sort of thing. But when it come to actually going out on a journey, no. And, you know, I suppose I was probably the most experienced person on the base, more so than Brian Foote, because he'd spent the year at Anvers. Mm. So, and if anybody was to go out on the sea ice, they were not to camp on it. That was most important. You know, we were pretty horrified when we learnt that these three guys had disappeared. Brian wanted to help as much as he could, and there was another sledging party from base, like the previous year. This group had been put down at the refuge. That second year, a group had been put down, taken by the Biscoe, and put down on at the south end of Lallemand Field, and they were to, but they were going to go back to a base Y refuge hut, and they were there, and they actually helped in looking for the people who'd gone out to the Dion Islands, helped the other base Y personnel. Brian also said we must help, so we immediately, I went down into the south of Lallemand Field. Brian went into Hennussy Bay, but on the extremely off chance that we might find, for instance, dogs, and throw some light on this. I don't think there was any chance of finding the people, because they'd gone out in a very different direction. There was a place called the Gullet between Adelaide Island and the Arrowsmith Peninsula, which is nearly always open water. I don't think anybody would have got through there. So we helped a bit. But, we weren't out very long, about a week, something like that. But we very carefully camped on islets, on rock, on solid rock, and reckoned that we'd be reasonably safe up on one or other little islands up, well, not very much above sea level, but probably sufficient, and not on the sea ice. And then it was after that that there was this huge storm, and the ice did not go out. And at that point, I realised that things had changed, and we'd be okay. And we camped on sea ice. You know, we even went out to the Biscoe Islands, to the Chilean refuge hut out there. much to Brian, he was very upset about that.
Why was that?
Well, going into a foreign, you know, enemy's refuge hut. So obviously, you know, he'd been, as Brian, base leader, it was against the political rules. Down there, it seemed to be a bit different, you know.
Was there any discussion about the three men afterwards? The sort of, is that not exactly post-mortem, but a discussion of what went wrong and why, and how?
Oh yes,
how things should be adapted for the future procedures.
Oh yes, very much so. You know, but you know, we got our rules by then. Effectively, you did not go onto the sea ice until you were reasonably assured that it was going to stick. Certainly in Lallemand Field and anywhere else for that matter. I mean, they had virtually the same sort of setup. Really, I mean, they should not have. They must have either camped on the sea ice or camped on a very low sort of beach or something like that, where you know, it was it, they would be subject to the sea. but I'm just, you know, mm. I say we didn't have anything. We tried to help as much as we could. Our sledge party that was down in that area did help quite a bit. The one with John Rothero was with that little group, who later has become so famous, his name.
Did it leave a pall over Graham Land, that incident? Did it change the mood on your base?
No. No, people... seemed to get over it very, very, very quickly. Mm. I think if the sea ice had continued to be like it had been the previous years, there would have probably been a bit of a problem. But with the sea ice being so good and people were most intent on making these plateau journeys, that seemed to be, you know, what most of the people wanted to do. Plateau journey was something which was a bit of a fixation.
You didn't do any breeding of dogs at...
Oh, yes, we did.
You did?
Yes.
I thought there had been a new policy at that point of no breeding except at the central point. There was a central policy.
No, that was being set up.
Ah.
It started. The two of our bitches were going to go to a breeding centre. And, you know, we had the... I should say that I would guess virtually two-thirds of the conversation at the base was to do with dogs. Mm. And dog things, including, of course, breeding things. So...
there was discussion about this plan to do central breeding. Was it well received as an idea?
Oh yes, on the whole, we weren't.
Why was that?
I don't think I can really remember too much about that. I mean, by that time we had a huge number of dogs. We had something like five nine dog teams. We got gone up from this poor. Something like 21 plus a few when I started, for the previous year, even fewer, up to something like over 40 or so. So, and, you know, there was plenty of discussion about breeding. Most of the breeding was inadvertent breeding. Dogs getting loose. Just why a breeding centre was necessary.
They can manage that, could they?
Well, dogs can manage all that themselves perfectly well, you know. Mm. So, you know, but anyway, yeah, we were like to think that we were going along with it. Certainly there was scope for improvement of the dogs, in particular the trait of being timid was my main problem. There were five bitches, as I said, from which had been born the previous year when the hut was being constructed, and they'd been more or less let loose and to find their own way of things whilst people built the hut and got things going, and so they weren't really brought under sort of human control properly for that whole time. And they ended up being two or three of them were, they'd get loose, run off and not come back. Very, very timid of people, which dogs shouldn't be, et cetera, et cetera. So up on the glacier, for instance, there's one dog, Millie, she was very adept at... getting out of her harness, find any way of escaping, going buzzing off, and of course distracting the team, this sort of thing. So to try and avoid that particular sort of trait was something which was a long-term thing would be not something that I could cope with.
Mm.
But it was obviously something that Fids should have paid attention to. But there are other traits as well, like having nice big burly dogs like Bodger and Fluke to pull big heavy loads.
There's a note in the paperwork I sent about Minerva giving birth to 6 pups.
Yes.
But they all died.
Well, yes. Well, this was up in the glacier. This, when we were out, John Smith and I had this couple of days out on the ice. There'd been inadvertent mating with the dog getting loose when Minerva was on heat. Earlier, when we were at in the vicinity of the refuge hut, and I think we'd been taken back to detail earlier when Ozzie Connicky and Bill McDowell, I think, had come over in at great personal risk over in the dinghy from detail to the refuge.
Mm.
But it wasn't possible to leave Minerva, obviously, at the refuge. Neither was it possible to take her back to the base, so she came with us on Angus's plateau journey and gave birth up on the plateau in the middle of a 9 or 10 day blow. So, you know, there was no chance for them. Sad that, but I don't know. There was no other decision that could have been made. You know, I didn't make any decision. That was Angus who was in charge. But I would have done the same if I'd, been him. There was nothing else that could have been done, really.
Were there
other... Or not to go.
Yeah, well, quite. Were there other field incidents that you remember, you recall? Dodgy moments or odd moments?
Well, not really, not a lot. they're often quite amusing instrument.
I'm happy to hear about that.
Well, as I kind of said, Ozzie Connicky I discovered very, very quickly that he was going to make a film, and I've never seen this film. It must exist, but. For some reason or other, and you know, never contacted him because he came away a year before me. What happened to the film, I don't know, but we were going to sledge out to up to Darble Bay. First night we distrusted the sea ice, you see, so I was camped up on Mist Island. It's about 10 miles north of the base hut. And I was busy, I'm going to make a film of you making camp. Instead of two of us were supposed to make camp, which admittedly he did later on, to be fair to him. But that particularly, I was doing the whole job of erecting the camp, feeding the dogs, doing everything. Busy filming this. At some stage or other, I walked backwards, presumably to put in a tent peg or so, and promptly fell into a crevasse backwards. And apparently this is uproariously funny, according to my brother, who did see the film, yes. that's another occasion this often happens, actually, but Brian and myself on sledging along on our skis on each side of the sledge, the dogs going on a nice hard surface, and suddenly I slipped or something, and left Brian with the dogs going on. I was, stop, all you've got to do is turn the sledge over smartly and they will stop. But he just went on and on into the distance. And there was me, ending up about half a mile behind. shouting and cursing the bass leader, which he didn't much like. But we got over that.
Brian Foote, in his reports, mentions quite a few shortages that he was finding frustrating and a cause of stress, he thought, at the camp. Short of rope, ice axes, harnesses, safety gear, and also a shortage of seals as well, because you had so many dogs.
Yes.
Do you remember those problems?
I can remember him complaining about, you know, the shortages. I don't know how they'd arisen, probably because Fids hadn't supplied enough, I would guess. I mean, they were on a, looking at it now, they were on obviously a budget. Mm. Certainly there was a shortage of ice axes. We were probably doing so much sledging that Fids just hadn't allowed for all this. they might have done it Hope Way, but Hope Bay. But you know, Base W was regarded as a meteorological base as well. The seals was a problem. There just weren't enough seals turning up in the vicinity of the base, and obviously, though we had a dinghy, the dinghies weren't very satisfactory. The seagull engines, there was something wrong with them, and I've forgotten just what it was. They were always conking out in it one way or another. And there were a few seals. The seals just didn't seem to like to come near our base. The Bisco would shoot. They actually shot out 50 or 100 seals, you know, and bring them to the base. I've got a note about even at Anvers Island, them going out and shooting seals, and they were for Base W, which had a shortage of seals, and of course the dog population grew. Mm. So he was quite right to make those comments.
Do you think these shortages did generate stress in the party in the hut, or was it all very relaxed?
I don't know much about the other people in the house. They're so little.
Mm. You're in the field so much, yeah.
Fielded so much with just one person. Mm. Certainly there was an awful lot of argy-bargy, I'd say, in that period before when the ship was close. But before that, everybody seemed to be reasonably happy. I mean, as base leader, it was his responsibility to draw attention to any shortage. I think I would have done the same if I was him, but I was not the base leader, so I wasn't worried too much about shortages, particularly shortages for the following year.
For somebody who wasn't that bothered about going, how would you rate the Antarctic as an episode in your life?
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. I never wanted to go back again.
You didn't?
No, I wouldn't have done what John Smith did. But, you could never tell just what was going to happen down there.
Do you think it shaped your life or changed your personality or attitude in any way?
I wouldn't have said so, no. I would have said not.
So you came back and you spent a couple of years writing up your results.
Well, no, one year.
One year.
But I had my PhD already, so I didn't need to do more than a year writing up and providing what is now a classic report. Like others of that vintage, Peter Hooper's or Robin Curtis's and so on. And as I get back to what I originally said, very lucky to be able to do that. If somebody comes down and redoes it now, which could be done, they'd see everything very different and so on, but that would be the classic report. So I'm quite happy with that. Like, any mistake, and there are hordes of mistakes, inevitably, you know, can be glossed over because, you know, just in the same way that Sir Raymond Priestley's work can be glossed over.
You were looking for a job then when you finished your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I was looking for a job in a year after I got back in 1960, yes.
What happened?
I was looking around, got the prof, get back to the prof, find your job, one opportunity, Canberra, Australia, with the geophysical laboratory. didn't like that much, so, okay, he's done his job, he's tried to find you a job, and that's it. Which is, you know, think of that in comparison with what happens now. Don't suppose the prof's even know my grandson. Probably hasn't even met him. but such a difference.
So where did he get to get work?
Well, I tried one or two other places. I would have liked to have been a lecturer. So I tried a lectureship for one or two places. But then there was an offer of a job with the United Steel Company with a guy called Dr. Bill Davies up in Rotherham, and a definite offer. My salary had then gone up, with FIDS, gone up to about £700 a year, which is quite, with the PhD, that had happened in the Antarctic, actually. It was quite amusing because every now and again, coded messages came for the base leader. He was out sledging. I was in base for a little while, so it was my job to decode the message and decode the message at great length, taking ages and ages to do it, and it ends up, you know, Dennis Goldring to receive, you know, £200 increase in salary or something, like that playing Monopoly. Very nice. there was an offer for a job for about £1,000 a year, which was about a assistant lecturer's salary, a bit more actually, with United Steels at Rotherham. So
using your geology.
Yes.
Doing what? Looking for iron ores.
Well, it was basically using my petrology, and we were going to look at all the rough stuff that metallurgists don't like looking at. They only like looking at stainless steel or alloys, if possible. That's their sort of university upbringing. So anything like coke, coal, slag, iron ore, limestone, and anything that all the raw materials that came into United Steels, and the materials going in as far as the blast furnace, or even out of the blast furnace, like slag and so on, were under his wing. And so I wasn't going to be a field geologist. I was going to be somebody who was basically looking under the microscope with some field work. But more importantly, of course, a reasonable salary. Good, a pension, proper pension, of course. Not that I took any notice of that at that time. But I thought I might eventually become a lecturer, but I've always just stayed with the steel industry.
There's news now that a detail is to be preserved as a monument.
Yes.
You alluded to it earlier with several artefacts from your era still inside there.
Well, they are. Yes, a lot.
How do you feel about that?
I'm quite happy. I hadn't realised that there were any official documents. There might not be. I mean, a lot of the documents might just be metadata sheets or something like that, which are not really relevant. But I would have thought that somebody should have a look through any documentation was there. Because, you know, any Tom, Dick and Harry can go and visit the place, can't they?
Well, they've got to get there first.
Well, but yachts come in. There's been quite a number of yachts over the years, so it's quite possible to get there. So, but otherwise, it's all right. I wouldn't have minded if it had just got lost, quite honestly.
Finally,
it doesn't really matter much to me.
Oh, right, okay. You kept a diary, Dennis?
Yes.
Whilst you were down there.
Mm.
Tell me a bit about the writing of the diary. What were you recording? Recording your finds or your personal feelings? Or?
Well, there are not much about my personal feelings at all. It's mostly just of events, the weather at that time, that sort of thing. What happened with? So I do know. When I was out and where I was, there's the field notebooks as well, which of course are held by Bass. They record all the geology, and they were given up at. I've never seen those again since I left Birmingham, and. Because you know the report was written, I've never done any further work. Never had the opportunity to anyway. Neither has anybody else, which they might have done. They might have worked on my samples.
Your diaries.
But the diaries.
They were left at Detail, weren't they?
No. There's no diaries at Detail. Well, I think. I think there's probably reports. We always wrote reports. We wrote sledging reports. So, for instance, and sometimes special reports. There would be a handwritten one of these, and then we would have in some cases typed them up. Now there would be a few carbon copies. Mm. I think it would be that sort of thing. But there will not be any actual diary.
All right. Well, we'll stop the conversation here. I'm going to pass you 2 pages for the copy from notes or notebooks that you left at Detail and were rescued in the 1990s by Antarctic Heritage Trust.
Right.
Which were then brought back to Britain at that point. So. There they are, and there's a typed up version in Bergy bits.
Right. There yeah. As well. Yeah. Well, we saw this. This was published earlier this year, wasn't it?
Yeah. So these aren't diaries. These are your notebooks at the time.
This is probably there is a gap in the diary, and I think that's probably what this is.
Well, there we are, Dennis. There's your missing.
Mm.
Thank you very much.